Tuesday, July the 7th, stage 4 of the Tour de France. We're in Carcassonne, a town that will be very familiar to a lot of listeners. A lot of you will have been here, famous fortified medieval city, certainly the old part in the south of France. So called because of a story, etiological story involving Lady Carcass, Saracen queen, throwing a pig fed with wheat off one of the towers. I believe in the bells ringing, hence the son, so Lady Carcass. The bells were ringing to celebrate this moment when the siege against Charlemagne's army was called off in the 7th or 8th century. I think I'm getting that vaguely right. Anyway, standing in the spot now, which brings back a lot of memories for me, because it was literally here. I'm standing sort of in the old mix zone of a few years ago, where we saw Mark Cavendish come over the line and crown his fantastic career in 2021 with that record equaling 34th stage win in the Tour de France. Davide Ballerini, his Astana teammate, I remember him sort of exclaiming, "Abbiamo fatto la storia," we've made history, and Cavendish had made history. And what a career it was for Mark Cavendish, an example of someone who obviously burst onto the scene very young, did his first Tour de France 2007, a bit older than Paul Sexas was. That tour didn't go too successfully. He didn't win a stage, but then came back the following year, won four stages, and the rest is history. But then other reminders as well here. Carcassonne, 2006, stage win for a gentleman, a rider called Yaroslav Popovich, who when he turned professional a few years before that, in the early 2000s, he was billed as a new Eddie Merckx, as something like what Tadej Pogacar has gone on to become. It did not pan out that way for Yaroslav Popovich, who went on to have a solid career, but not one that was bejeweled with victories in the world's biggest races. He was mainly a domestique for Lance Armstrong. So I suppose in that dichotomy, a bit of a lesson when we think about Paul Sexas and his career. Although after 4 days, as we're about to find out, 4 days of his Tour de France career, the signs look pretty good at this point.
Series on Paul Sexas. First thing you said is don't put too much pressure on him, and that's what we keep hearing. But let's define pressure. And what were the types of pressure? Because there are different types of pressure. What were the types of pressure that most got to you, particularly when you were a young rider?
Outside pressure, like pressure, something comes from outside. I think that's how you could sum up. Or expectation, I guess. Like you put pressure on yourself because you know what you do. You know what you can do, you know the work you put in, you know where you're at. External pressure is an expectation, and you have no control over that. You have no control over what is the bar that you're supposed to achieve. And that's the difficult thing to... It's human nature for that to be the hardest thing to kind of suppress. Especially in the modern world. And unfortunately, as a sports person, that's what the majority of the pressure comes from. You tell me, you're a German.
You said don't put too much pressure on, and this is something that we have to bear in mind as Germans, because often we're writing or we're saying, oh, hopefully the French don't put pressure on him. But we're subduing it ourselves by talking about him all the time. I mean, I'm following him on the whole tour, and that's a lot of attention.
You're quite old school, like impartial journalist, aren't you? So, you know what I mean? You're doing the thing on sex, I suppose.
A bit easier because he's not at the point yet where, like, it's still good if he wins. It's not a failure if he loses, you know. And as long as he can stay that side of that line,
yeah,
that's better. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. When did that flip for you? Because he must have done probably within a year or two. It was, you know,
okay, 2009, right. 2010 was a Tour de France for me. Remember, I had dental problems, was 2010.
Yeah.
And I nearly didn't come to tour that year because I'd only won like two races. But like, to now, and then I'm on five stages of the tour. Like that was the difference, you know. And then that was the I think that was the change. So not a nice place to be. That it changes kind of the love you have for stuff.
Yeah, and it's when so. How did you learn? What was the best thing that you learned, or the most effective thing you learned in interviewing with it? And did that come from you, or did that come from advice from someone else?
I was quite, I don't know, just as I got older, still care, but you don't care. As long as you know what you do. It's noise, but it's just noise. It's like it flies around, you know what I mean? Like from, you can flap away. And there comes a point when you just get pissed off in the end, isn't there, you know? And that would happen, it did happen here. For the most part, you just kind of focused on what you were doing, you know?
Ça revient, it's coming home. How France will win the tour again is a Kilometre Zero series written and produced by me, Daniel Freiber. Ad-free versions of these episodes will be available exclusively for friends of the Cycling Podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up as a friend of the podcast, and please remember that by doing so, you are enabling us to cover the Grand Tours on the ground and produce these special series and episodes. Any hotter than a team time trial on your first day of the tour when you're Paul Sexas. The temperature that morning was suitably furnace-like. Decathlon had reasons for optimism. For example, their third place in the same format in Paris-Nice, and to a lesser extent their sixth position at the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. There were also some causes for slight concern, like the way they'd somewhat fallen apart after leading at the first split in Paris-Nice, leaving Dan Holler to save them with a monster solo turn. Or the fact that one of their time trial specialists, Stefan Bissiger, hadn't even made the tour team after an underwhelming Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. If Sexas had good reason to feel more nervous than usual, it was also going to be a challenging day for the team's sports directors, coaches and other gurus. At least they were well prepared, perhaps more so than others. As their head of coaching, the Irishman Stephen Barrett told me.
Where did it start from, the planning?
No, so the planning for today really began once the parkour came out back in last December. We saw the parkour, and one of the first things we did was we saw the stage one was a team time trial in Barcelona, and we immediately booked a time on the Circuit Catalunya Formula One track so we could do some preparation here. So we spent three hours on the track on Thursday, so 2 days ago. Which ended up being really quite good because we had many, many teams trying to negotiate some time with us in the last week or two.
Buy off you?
Yeah.
What was the biggest offer?
It was kind of like, it was a few, but some teams came in quite late looking, could we share the track and, you know, let's help you, we'll help you. But for us, it was we got in early, so we were lucky. It was quite a few teams did it. I know Visma did, Ineos, Trek were on just after us. That was really where it all started, the preparation for today.
And then you obviously had a dress rehearsal in the Dauphiné. I mean, obviously it was a pretty different course, but how useful was that? Because, you know, I mean, the result wasn't necessarily what the team wanted. There was that moment where Dan Holler was sort of saying to Paul, maybe, you know, calm down. But how useful was that?
No, it was good because that was really the bulk of the Tour de France team. We also had the TTT in Paris-Nice, again, which gave the team a lot of confidence. That was a really good performance, one of our best performances in the team time trial for many years. And then with the Dauphiné team time trial, I was the bulk of the team that we have here this week. That allowed us to get a bit more information of where Paul was, because it was Paul's first team time trial with the team. It's his first team time trial as a professional. So even for him to learn the feeling, we know he's physically very, very strong, but actually in the team time trial, it doesn't matter how strong you are, it's how efficient you are. So that gave us a lot of information. Then we could use that then in the previous weeks. Even before Dauphiné, we spent 3 weeks in Sierra Nevada, and we did five big days of TTT preparation as well to really learn as much as we could, find the best setup, find the best lineup, where to position riders. So, yeah, we have our lineup set really the last couple of weeks.
I mean, Stephen, when I look at the resources that go into this kind of thing now, I mean, it tends to... you might say it's hundreds of thousands, but tens of thousands of euros. Yep. And people might say, well, the delta can't be more than about, between a good performance and a bad performance, can't be more than about 20 seconds.
Yep.
So why spend that much time and money on it? What would you say to that?
I think it's twofold. One is that it really is, it's a shop window for brands to show how advanced they are. I think really there's a bit of a battle behind between bike brands, between different wheel brands, tire brands, and really is the ultimate showcase of how fast your material is. And when you go to the mountains, it's more about the riders, but this really is a shop window for what teams do. And what it does, it I think it really, I suppose, presents to other teams and riders of how serious we take this. You know, today, you're right, it's between a good performance and a bad performance is maybe 20, 30 seconds, but we want to be with those top teams, and we know now what's required to go into it. Like you said, tens of thousands, of course, we got special skin suits, we got special helmets, we got all these cooling systems here. We see today it's going to be 30 degrees. We got sushi machines, we've got you know, no stone left unturned. So, tens of thousands, I guess, has probably been a little bit... safe.
So, I mean, how much has he had to learn? Because, you know, we sort of hear all the time what the basic principles, what the golden rules are. Team charge, obviously, don't go crazy when you take the pull, try and keep it steady. I mean, how much of a sort of full immersion has it been for him in the last couple of weeks?
It's been a lot because he is still learning how strong he is. He still doesn't realize actually how it is, and him in a team time trial effort, he can feel it's quite easy, you know, and I can push harder. But what we'll teach him is don't push harder, just push longer. And that really is trying to maximize and maintain the speed of the team. It's not Paul plus seven, we're eight riders. And he's learned that really quite well. We spend a lot of time on the track. We spend a lot of time on the road in Sierra Nevada. And also you have some experienced riders here like Dan Hull, like Olaf Coy, like Tish Banut, who've done lots of team time trials, and they really are huge knowledge bases for him as well. Same with Lucro, that he learns and understands. And we had a really good briefing last night about the TTT with Mark Quad, who's one of our coaches as well, who's got lots of experience in team time trials for many, many years. And you can just see he sits there and he absorbs it all. He's really good to take information on, but he's still learning, which is exciting.
The time now is 2:15, first day of the Tour de France, 3 hours roughly until the race starts. I've been down at the Decathlon bus talking to their coach, Stephen Barrett, about what's going to be a really big day for Paul Sexton. There's a huge number of people around the Decathlon bus. In fact, I was talking to someone from EF Education, who I think is sharing a hotel with Decathlon, and they were stunned at the number of guests. And it's just, I think, a lot of guests, a lot of VIPs there for Decathlon today, sort of underlining, I suppose, what a big deal this tour is going to be for them. It's going to be an even bigger deal when we get to France, of course. On that subject, the team manager Dominique Sarriez has been saying on RMC radio that the pressure is going to mount and it's going to get even more asphyxiating for Paul Sexton when we get to France. He fully anticipates that. Sarriez, incidentally, was also talking about Sexton's contract situation, which is going to be a big topic of conversation on this Tour de France, or was going to be, because Sarriez has tried to sort of kill that by saying that Sexton himself has asked for all contract negotiations to be postponed until the period, and he was very specific about this, between mid-August and mid-September. How are Decathlon going to get on today? Well, we heard Stephen Barrett talk about it there. Another English-speaking member of their staff, incidentally, Paul Barrett, similar name, former director of innovation at Ineos between, I think, 2019 to 2022. Now he does that job for Decathlon. He's been talking about how this race today is basically a maths problem, and he's run a simulation thousands of times to see what's the best combination of riders, where they should all pull. So we'll see how effective that is. I am going to take my position behind the finish line up here in Montjuic and wait. As I and the rest of the Sexas stalkers waited by the Decathlon bus that afternoon, we were served a stark reminder of how asphyxiating the tour and its attendant pressures can be, particularly for a young rider. In our podcast chronicling Sexsize's coming of age at the Tour of the Basque Country in the spring, we asked Kian Uterbrooks what he had learned in his brief golden boy era and what advice he would give Sexsize. This was Uterbrooks then.
I think, you know, once you're in the flow of it, it's super nice because for sure you are in one time with one, you're the, one of the best riders in the world. But then it's for sure difficult to keep at that level and to not let your head go down when it goes for 1 year or half a year a bit worse. And I think that's the hardest part of it, but you should just enjoy it now.
But in that episode, we also touched on the various hurdles the young Belgian had faced over the last few years, some physical, some psychological. And here he was facing another one of the former, and perhaps a bit of the latter, on his first day as a Tour de France rider, now aged 23. On each of the last uphill sections towards Montjuïc, Uterbrooks seemed to fall apart, with teammates Pablo Castrillo and Raúl García Pierna slowing significantly to wait for him, then eventually having to leave him behind. When he got back to the team bus a few minutes later, he was visibly upset. Teammate Mikel Hessman was the first to console him, then director sportif José Joaquín Rojas, followed by team manager Eusebio Unzué. Unzué shrugged when I asked him what he'd made of it. "He's young. This will be a learning experience," he then told me rather hopefully.
Eusebio.
Uterbrooks then had the good grace to tell me very briefly what had happened.
Yeah, could I just ask you one question in English?
Really fast, but we had already 15,000.
Oh, you didn't know. I was just to sum up what happened, just very quickly in English, if you could.
Yeah, I mean, I had cramps before the first climb, and then it was surviving, let's say. Once it's there, and then you cannot do much.
This scene, sort of peeing to the vulnerability of youth, was quickly juxtaposed with a very different one. Sexsize swooping down the hill seconds after crossing the line and immediately vaulting onto his turbo trainer like a cowboy into the saddle. He ended up staying there, spinning out the toxins for over half an hour. He would only talk when the race was over, the results all in, his press officer informed us. He watched the battle for yellow on a mobile phone balanced on his handlebars, his gaze not moving from the screen. Finally, with the scores all in, Jonas Vingegaard's yellow jersey and Decathlon's sixth place confirmed, Sexsize gave us his verdict. This having had to bend down to collect the brand new sponsor's watch he'd remembered to put on for media duties, which had fallen to the tarmac, causing a brief moment's panic.
It's really good. Of course, it's special because it's a TTT, so we are really focused. And I take it as a normal TTT, and we did a great job today.
Well, in the Dauphiné, the people in the team said you learned a lot in the team time trial. What was the main lesson that you took into today's race?
I would say it was, we learned a lot because it was really difficult. We had some great goals, but the problem was we were six and soon five at the Dauphiné, so it was really different today. And we did the better we can do today. And that's the most important for me.
We also, the announcement with your grandparents. Did you talk to them before? Did you, you know, think about them? What was your day in relation with your grandparents?
Yeah, of course, it was really something special for my grandparents. I think they were watching the TV today. I see them this week, at the start of the week, and they were really happy. And I hope they will enjoy this Tour de France.
When you see the shape of Pogacar, Jonas, Solis, are you just want to get cracking and get fighting with them?
Yeah, of course, they are the best of the world, so I guess we'll see how it goes on during the weeks, and I hope to be, I hope to really perform and see what I can do, and yeah, of course, they are the greatest cyclists for the moment, so.
Last question.
Paul, what do you make of the route for tomorrow for your characteristics?
What do you say?
What do you make of stage two?
We had a plan. We put a lot of preparation and planning into how we were going to execute the race. think what we can be happy with is that the guys executed the plan that we gave to them. We were a little bit slow, I think, in the opening time check, which wasn't the plan. But what we saw after that was the guys got faster and faster, and we kind of came into the race and finished very, very strong. I think in terms of finishing time, it wasn't so much the time, it was where we were going to be. We did say a top five would be a really incredible result, because we've seen the other teams who are here. Finished sixth, so I think we're in our place, which is good.
Yes, if you want to partir, je vais demander. Yes.
Tadej Pogacar's polka dot jersey for the fastest ascent of the final ramp was not the prize he or his UAE team had wanted on the first day, but it was one they would take. Many thought Vingegaard's stewardship of yellow may be brief, perhaps as little as 24 hours. Three ascents of the Castel de Montjuïc climb in the last 40 kilometres gave stage 2 a passing resemblance to Flèche Wallonne, where of course Sexas was the winner in April. But naturally, the Mur de Huy also figures among Pogacar's conquests. And here he could avail himself of something for which Sexas would possibly have no answer, an Isaac del Toro. Of course, Sexas and del Toro have much in common. Not least, they were both about to tackle their first road stage in a Tour de France. A landmark, usually an emotional one, for any rider, as NSN's George Bennett confirmed.
George, how are you?
Sorry.
It's fine, don't worry about it.
Yeah,
you're right. Well, George, a very specific thing for me. Cast your mind back, 2016, your first Tour de France.
Yeah.
Emotionally, what was that experience like? Just talk to me about what it meant for you.
It was a super exciting time. I remember it really well because I actually wasn't meant to do the Tour, but I was riding really well that year, and I did a great Dauphiné, and I was like, surely I'm going to do the Tour. And they were like, no, you're not doing the Tour. And then I went on holiday with my fiance, and Gissing crashed, and I went, I've just had a week on the beach here, what's going on? And then they rang me, you're doing the Tour. And they drove a trainer down to Font-Romeu, to Les Anglais. Actually, we stayed right by the bottom of where we finished yesterday. And they drove a trainer down, and me and my girlfriend, we went there, and we just did a five-day camp. And they're like, right, let's just see what happens. And I ended up having a great Tour. I mean, I was just going in breakaways and having fun, and it was no pressure. But I remember how exciting it was. And then, I mean, it wasn't until 2017 where I really like stepped into sort of trying to do the GC thing, and that was when the Tour really exploded for me. But, I think I have great memories of the Tour. Every Tour I've been to, I've had really special memories from, actually.
George, talking of first Tours, what do you make just generally, Paul Sexas, what do you make of him?
Oh, mate, he's unbelievable. I mean, look, I don't put him here as a threat level to Poggy or probably Jonas or Isaac, but I think in the context of the fact that he's 19, it's unbelievable how good he is. I mean, I think about me as a 19-year-old. I don't even know if I really raced bikes, so his potential is, we don't know what his potential is. I mean, could he supersede Pog? I don't know. I mean, it's hard to imagine that there's a better cyclist than Tadej. I mean, I don't know if he will be or not, but it's amazing what he does at his age, and I think you can see why teams are lining up to sign him.
My name is John Degenkolb from Team Picnic PostNL. Gave me memories for the rest of my career, for the rest of my life, and we won the first stage with Marcel Kittel. We're trying to defend the jersey on the second day. We didn't succeed in that, but it was just like, it's really, really amazing. I mean, these moments you experience, that really like shapes your career. And I think it's something really unique. It's something really special for him now also to have that support of the team behind him. And I also believe it's good that they not only focused on him, that they also brought Olaf and Case for the sprints, and it also puts maybe just a little bit, but it puts some pressure off his shoulders in the end.
Ben O'Connor racing for Team Jacob Oluwa.
Yeah, I remember it was still those funny times, 2021, so I remember the presentation. There wasn't heaps of people. It was kind of weird, on-off weather and raining. But then once we started the race, I think I actually remember the first couple of kilometres, I was like, oh my god, wow. Just a little 5 foot of break was just warp speed. Then that tension that we had throughout that whole stage was something new. Like, just the more the tension the whole day. And yeah, those big crashes that were happening, that kind of is what defined my first day of the Tour de France. The sign, and I thought I broke my shoulder, and then the next one, which was even scarier, you know, it was a big step up. I'd been pro for a couple of years by then. That was my fifth year, and that was the moment I always wanted to have, was to race at the Tour. So you kind of had to take it in your stride, and that first day was shit. But I didn't stop because it was the Tour. There was no way I was gonna stop, and that was. I think in other races it would have been easier to have given up under that pretense of not being able to move much on the bike, and that's probably what makes it that next kind of thing. It's that meaning, that deep meaning behind it.
If you'd been dropped in at age 19, the age that success is, I mean, think of where you were at 19. How would you have coped with that?
Yeah, I mean, that was my first year out of school, wasn't it? 18, 19. I think I had started to drink a lot less by that point. I started cycling, but...
Were you still bowling at that point? Were you still turning your arm over?
I was still playing cricket till I was 20. I was still opening the batting. Bowling wasn't my strong point, actually, funnily enough. But, yeah, I was still riding for the pleasure of it and being told I was really strong. But opening the batting, playing districts cricket, just hoping one day I could actually play cricket rather than cycling.
The Tour had reached its lowest ever latitudinal point with the stage start in Tarragona. And alas, things seemed to be going south for Sexas when both he and Olaf Coy suffered punctures moments apart, shortly before the start of the hilly Montjuïc circuits with 40 kilometres to go. Sexas initially swapped bikes with Aurélien Paris-Peintre, then waited for a team car to finally give him his spare. Decathlon's head DS Luke Rowe instructed his teammates not to drop back. Better to float through the convoy of team cars than get barraged and thereby denied any slipstream from the cars. Inevitably, what occurs when teammates drop back to help a stricken leader. The Decathlon team bus was parked in the same location as the previous day on the downslope off Montjuïc. And again, Sexas arrived with a flourish. A benign Billy the Kid bursting through the saloon door, then filling the space with his words and energy. No sooner had he climbed aboard his turbo trainer than the Sexcast went on air, his excitable monologue to any teammate or staff member in his midst, recounting his day. Communication had been more complicated on the road, as he explained.
Encore une fois, il y a eu un petit problème d'oreillette. J'essaie de leur dire que je pense qu'il manquait un peu pour vraiment attaquer. Et du coup, mon directeur sportif ne comprenait pas. Il croyait que j'étais à 100%, je pense. Donc, du coup, il a fait rouler tige.
The DSs hadn't heard or understood him saying he didn't feel up to attacking, hence why Benoît had surged to the front at the bottom of the final climb, as per the plan they had laid out in the morning. Benoît's line that night, "We can almost live on the moon, but still can't communicate in a race." The following morning, he'd nuanced that slightly.
So I made a late move before the corner to the right, from down on the bottom. And I looked back, I know he was 7th, 8th wheel, and also... The plan was that he would be behind Jonas Rotade on this part, just to be able to react. The plan we made in the bus was that I would go hard on the bottom, and we continued with the plan because he said he felt good, and I think also the pace was high enough, that's why they were in the text in the end. So it was in the descent pretty fast into the last 600 meter. He was just on a small gap, and I think he managed really well for his first.
Ninth place for the youngest rider to even compete in the race since 1937 was a mighty result. And yet, for once, he had been upstaged by another precocious talent, Isaac del Toro, admittedly 3 years Sexas' senior. The image of Tadej Pogacar and del Toro crossing the line almost hand in hand was judged by some pundits to violate an unwritten moral code. It was unclear whether this was what Tom Pidcock was getting at when he reacted as follows.
It takes the piss a little bit, doesn't it?
Several French pundits seemed especially put out, perhaps forgetting that a Frenchman, Romain Bardet, had done something similar with Frank Vandenbroek on the first day of the tour in 2024. Or that Sexas had played butler to Nicolas Prodhomme in last year's Tour of the Alps. Del Toro and Sexas' head-to-head battle at the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes had lasted 13 minutes 58 seconds. That was the time it took Sexas to climb the Côte de Crévolande, trying but not managing to dislodge Del Toro. Sexas had then crashed out of contention the following day and pulled out early on the final stage. But Del Toro's commanding overall victory in his absence had raised two hypotheticals. Who would have won that race and, much more alarming, in fact a notion that made French hearts shudder, was what if Del Toro is Pogacar's true heir, not just as UAE's leader, but the sport's cannibalistic ruler. One of the juicier rumours circulating about Sexas' future beyond 2027 indeed went that UAE would decide whether to go all in on Del Toro or break the bank for Sexas based on who won the old Dauphiné. The cries that rang out over Montjuïc that evening were the patriotic outpourings of a crowd revelling in the glory of the present moment, rather than speculating about the future. Pogacar, brother, you're already Mexican, was the most memorable chorus, one that brought polka dots of glee to his cheeks to match the spots on his jersey. In the throng that evening, there were members of the Mexican diaspora, as well as fans of other nationalities who simply wanted to join in the fun on a day when Mexico's football team were to battle England in the Azteca Stadium for a place in the World Cup quarterfinals. Some of those celebrating had even played a meaningful part in Del Toro's rise. Andy Medina and I, or she in the cycling podcast, go back a while. In fact, to Del Toro's sensational maiden pro win at the Tour Down Under 2.5 years ago.
First of all, guys, to Andy, we know each other a little bit in the last couple of years because of Isabel Del Toro. What a day for you to be here, but we'll get on to that. And you're here with your husband, Roberto. Just remind me and remind everyone where your story with Isabel Del Toro starts, how it starts. That fighting over
here is going to You know the story from me. Now let's hear your story.
Yeah, well, we started supporting the AR Monex team in 2019 as sponsors, and it's just a team where we're...
Who are we talking about?
My company is EVA. It's a brand for salads and lettuce in Mexico. So our brand and some other Mexican brands and businesses started sponsoring this team just as a passion project, just to see... Know what would happen if we gave Mexican riders the opportunity to compete at the same level as the Europeans were, and giving these kids just a chance to develop and compete at the highest level. And you know, well, it's been amazing to see how fast the results have come, like with Isaac Del Toro today. So we're very excited.
And Andy's told me in the past, I think, but why cycling?
Well, personally, no, we've always liked cycling. We've been fans of cycling. And we always felt that Mexico should be a country that could produce world-class professional cyclists. And just the system wasn't in place to help the talent that was there to develop and to succeed. So we thought it was a good opportunity to find some success.
And you and I spoke, was it 2 years ago now? A bit more than 2 years ago when he won his first race in Tour Down Under. And everything you've told me since suggests that this thing in Mexico is really gathering momentum. And it's going to go to a different level today.
It is. Now we have another cyclist we just signed with Sudal Quickstep, which is amazing. His name is Said Cisneros. And he's an amazing, amazing cyclist. Romina is also with Lotto Sudal. She's one of the girls that has signed already. But there's a lot of them coming. Yeah, we have two more, two guys right now in the development team that are very promising. So yeah, it's becoming more and more common.
Is the biggest factor, is it having a good system, money, or is an even more important factor just having one talisman who shows everyone the way? Because in the United Kingdom, we kind of had this. We had a good system, but then we also had
Cavendish really opened the door, or Wiggins really opened the door, and then all of the others thought that it was possible. I mean, what's sort of more important?
I'd say it's both, because we had the system in place, and that's a system that developed Isaac and made Isaac succeed. But once Isaac was there, we could definitely tell how everything changed, the attitude, the psychology, the mentality of all the other cyclists, and the amount of interest that has been developed for cycling in Mexico as well. So I think it's both. It just makes them see that it's a possibility, that they can actually compete, and it just makes more people get drawn to the sport. So I think it's a mixture of both.
So today, Mexico are going to beat England in football. So tomorrow, what do the sports bulletins in Mexico look like, or the newspapers look like?
Hopefully, it will be both teams in the cover of things. I mean, soccer is the main sport in Mexico. It's huge. Like, it's really, really big. But this is also very special. Tour de France is Tour de France. So hopefully we get the same exposure with El Toro, hopefully.
Stage 3 would feature 4,000 meters of climbing. If that sounded a lot, Sexas had packed in around 44,000 more, or 48,000 in total, in Spain's Sierra Nevada in May. He and teammates, including Matthew Riquitello and Aurélien Paris-Peintre, had also done some of that climbing wrapped in long-sleeved jerseys and rain jackets, even with the temperatures in the 30s, to prepare for what they would face at the Tour. The heatwave was intensifying, like the debate about what, if anything, the Tour and the sport could do about it.
I'd be curious to see what that looks like, what we all pull over and have a drink. I mean,
in a pub.
I think what's been crazy is like how...
Certainly the conditions didn't seem to be affecting Sexas' joie de vivre, and not just experiencing the Tour, but racing as he had always done, with fire in his legs and belly.
I feel that it was incredible. All the public is, how many people there is in the side of the road, it's insane. It was really great, and I look forward to...
On this particular day, he would suffer but again shrug off another setback when his climbing Sherpa Riquitello crashed early in the stage and spent the rest of the day in the gruppetto.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what happened in the crash, but when the break was still forming, there was... I was on the left side of the road, and from what it looks like, someone came up the inside of Bruno Almaray and took him out, and then that just caused a bowling ball effect, took a bunch of us out, and there wasn't really anything I could do. I had, for the first 30 minutes after the crash, I had pretty bad knee pain, and was one of those things where it was, I couldn't pedal much with the right leg, and then as the stage went on, it got better.
By stage 6, you think you'll be recovered and ready by Tourmalet?
Yeah.
Up the road, the Tour crossed the border with 54 kilometers to go, not long after Pogacar had informed his men that, yes, he intended to feast yet again that afternoon. This time, Sexas was safely nestled in the world champion slipstream until the Benoit surge came with 1.2 kilometers to go, just as Del Toro was returning the previous day's favor and unleashing Pogacar. Sexas started his sprint in Vingegaard's wheel and more or less finished it there, although Richard Carapaz finally pipped into third place. Remco Evenepoel, Florian Lipovits and Juan Ayuso had not just finished behind Sexas, but conceded 2 seconds. It had been an impressive showing on Sexas' first day in the Tour de France in France. Felix Corschartner of UAE certainly thought so.
One question, how much talk is there in the bus about Sexas? He was fourth today. And is the feeling in the bus that he's going to be a real threat?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he showed all year that he's super strong. I mean, he's super young also, so it's also his first big tour. But for sure, you need to count him 100% for the GC. Yeah.
Thank you, God.
Fans had been asked not to attend the finish in Lezon due to the encroaching risk of nearby forest fires. Something else likely to sweep across French mountainsides over the next couple of days, sort of hysteria provoked by a 19-year-old cyclist, was therefore also held somewhat in check until the following morning in Carcassonne.
Il est jeune, il est lyonnais, non, on dit pas. Il est jeune, il est français. Et après, je sais pas comment rime, et donc je sais pas, il est plus fort que.
Christian had come to Carcassonne from Montpellier with his young son Hector. I didn't ask his profession, but on Tuesday morning at least, Christian qualified as a self-employed songwriter, although he admitted that some verses were still in the works. Christian's chants were tolerated and indulged outside the Decathlon team bus, although could one day fall foul of an anglophone broadcast watershed.
Allez, on va lancer un petit clapping pour le faire venir. C'est facile, tout le monde connaît. Sex. As. Sex. As. Sex. As. Sex. As.
One man who was smiling and generally ears was the compact, effervescent figure ferrying giant bottles of mineral water from the start village back to the Decathlon team bus. Amid a conclave of studious-looking, dark-haired 30-somethings scattered around the team vehicles, Sabino Pignatelli stands out not because of his slightly more advanced age or fairer colouring, but because the energy he exudes is that of a jaunty Disney character. He works for the team as a soigneur, the same job he's done for getting on for four decades. After sex has his victories, or indeed any time he crosses the line, you'll see Sabino wiping sweat and grime from the teenager's brow, handing him drinks, and often showering him with praise or words of comfort. Un champion, t'es un champion, a champion, you're a champion, is a phrase that nearby camera mics will often overhear. In Carcassonne, Sabino tells me a bit about his life and how cycling had become a passion first and then a job. His Italian parents had migrated from Salento in the south of Puglia as Italy rebuilt after the Second World War, but prospects still seemed better in France. The Pignatellis had settled in Saint-Étienne, to be precise, and it was there that Sabino's two brothers started racing bikes. A fanatical supporter of the city's football team, at first Sabino hated cycling, but would get dragged to races and eventually caught the bug. One of his brothers then started working as a masseur for a pro team, Saint-Étienne Pelousin.
Et bah, à l'époque de la guerre, et bah, il est venu en France bah, pour manger et voilà pour travailler.
He suggested Sabino also do some work experience after his military service. Sabino enjoyed it enough to enroll in a course in massage, then started to pick up gigs in any team that would take him on the road, in France, to Spain or Italy, where of course he also spoke the language. Over the years, he's massaged some fantastic riders, great people with remarkable CVs. Phil Anderson, Andy Hampston, Ben O'Connor, to name just some of those who come to mind. But no one, to date, quite like Paul Sexas. First time I met Paul was at La Marseillaise, the first race of his first pro season in 2025. I like working with the young riders because I don't really talk cycling with them, talk about life, how to really commit to their profession, doing it right. I told his parents not to worry, I'd be there. I like looking after the young ones. But it wasn't special treatment. I'm like that with all of the young guys. By the end of the year, I think Paul wanted me with him for every race, so he asked the team management, Dominique Sirayez and the others, whether I could be with him full-time. Now I even join him for the training camps before races, like at Sierra Nevada in January and in the spring. His legs are unusual, quite short relative to the length of his body, and unusual. You also notice how they're changing. I said to him the day before the Ardennes races, your legs are different. There's real power there. Not so much suppleness, but real power. I talked it through with the coach, and I think it comes down to how he prepares specifically for each race or each goal. He'd been working on his speed, his jump, so his legs had real force in them. Now at the Tour, I feel that force, but with a bit more suppleness mixed in. On the massage table, he puts his phone away. He never touches it. I switch mine off too. He just tosses it aside. I've rarely seen a young rider his age who isn't glued to his phone, to social media. He just doesn't want any of it. From day one, I could tell he's a kid who doesn't need that, doesn't need to know what people are saying or showing. He knows how he feels, in his head and his legs. Every day he asks me how his legs feel. We chat a bit at the start, then I let him be. Sometimes we'll go a whole hour without a word. He's calm, a bit in his own bubble. Honestly, no stress at all. His recovery is remarkable. Frankly, in 40 years, I've never seen a kid like him. His recovery is double, maybe triple, what I see in other riders.
parce que bah, tu sortais pas. Et les mecs, ils ont fait du rouleau pendant presque 3 semaines.
As we amble back towards Sabino's team bus, ready for another day on the tour, discussing what we've seen and Sexhouse has done so far, Sabino seems to be searching for superlatives that eluded him when the mic was on. It's as though, he says at one point, turning to me solemnly, Jesus has reached down and touched the kid with his finger.
Bah, oui, là, comme je dis souvent, Paul, il a la faculté de récupérer à une vitesse grand V. Chose que les autres coureurs, eh ben, plus les courses passent.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.